with our top story. Protesters rallied in the French capital, Paris, on Sunday to demand the French president and his government abandon a bill aimed at rooting out so-called Islamist extremism. Demonstrators at the event denounced the controversial new anti-Islam bill, stating that it could trample on religious freedoms and make all Muslims into potential suspects. The bill also tightens rules on the funding of mosques and non-governmental organizations dealing with or being run by Muslims. The bill, now called a draft law to strengthen Republican values, was first introduced by the president, Emmanuel Macron, last year in an attempt to root out what he's calling Islamic separatism. Macron's critics have lambasted this claim and deemed his actions Islamophobic. Well, Chris Denholm, the filmmaker and political commentator, is with us from the French capital. Chris, as always, it's good to talk to you. And coming to us from the French capital, are you getting a sense here that French Muslims perhaps feels this bill is putting their way of life under threat?
Certainly, because even if the French government denies it, the Muslim community is targeted as a community, and also Macron criticized Islam before. So this is a bill that is nefast because it's so-called discussed to increase security issues, but in reality it's targeting one community, the Muslim community. It asks the imams to subscribe a charter, which many of them refuse. It allows the French authorities to close Muslim associations, watchdogs like the CCIF. So there is a kind of general hysterical atmosphere in France, which is certainly stimulated by the presidential elections next year.
Now, you've answered a little bit there of the next question I wanted to ask you, which is why this bill would be seen as being anti-Islam. But is there a counter-argument that perhaps it's not just targeting Muslims?
No, well, it's not just targeting Muslims, because you see, you also see people, Black African associations, Arabs, popular people living in the popular areas in France. They feel targeted because this is about security, the so-called security, and there is a big discrepancy in the discourse of the officials. You have very big companies who receive a lot of money because of the COVID crisis, and they are still firing workers, like the Sanofi pharmaceutical company. Now, in the discussion in the National Assembly, in the French Parliament, the last weeks, those who will vote against the law, they use some interesting arguments, like what you see, the group of Mélenchon. They said the formulation of this bill is so ambiguous that it can be interpreted on different ways. So it opens the way to arbitrary decisions against the Muslim communities. Also, the other members of parliament said that the existing laws are more than sufficient to sanction people who call for hatred or use racist expressions or call for racism. So why an extra law is needed? This is certainly because there is a general feeling in the political class in France that they might need some more security laws in order to go further.
All right, Chris Denholm, thank you as always. Now, it's been exactly 10 years since uprisings rippled across the Persian Gulf region, bringing hope to human rights activists within and without. In Bahrain, particularly, a country with the greatest number of political prisoners in relation to the population size, people poured onto the streets hoping for change, but were met by a brutal crackdown. Since then, not much has changed, and activists accused the West of complicity by refusing to use their leverage then and now. Bianca Rahimi has this one.
February 2011. Emboldened by what was then hailed as the Arab Spring, people took to the streets in Bahrain. The crackdown that followed was brutal. Hospitals overflowed with the dead and injured, and the prisons filled up. on the 10th anniversary of the pro-democracy movement, the European Centre for Democracy and Human Rights held a conference. According to the speakers, the situation in Bahrain is worse now than before 2011, with hundreds of journalists, human rights defenders, and opposition figures still behind bars. The US and the UK have military bases in Bahrain. Human rights organizations say both are complicit in the monarchy's rights abuses by refusing to exert the influence they obviously have over the monarchy.
Bahrain is a political ally of the West. It's not some other, you know, this country that there is no kind of form of leverage or control over. In fact, the strength of US and British leverage on the regimes is so strong that it actually, I would say, coerce some of these regimes into entering the normalization deal with Israel that was perceived by, you know, across the board in Bahrain, you know, pro and anti-government people as the final act of betrayal.
One aspect of Bahrain's repressive tactics has received international attention: torture and sexual abuse used in prisons. And the UK's complicity is irrefutable. It trained Bahrain's police force, which carries out the torture, and the Special Investigations Unit, which continues to fail the victims. Some are on death row after giving false confessions under duress, and others live on with the horror playing before their eyes every day. We spoke to one of the victims.
It wasn't a prison, it was a morgue. You had no right to say you were innocent. If you did, they would start the torture, psychological torture. They would give us hallucination drugs. None of the guards were Bahraini. And they weren't normal. They were sick. They would make fun of us for missing our kids and family. Those who had kids were tortured the most. They weren't allowed to have visitors if they so much as drank water without permission. I think of those women. God help them.
Britain's top military brass were in Bahrain 5 days before the 2011 crackdown, in which 1,000 Saudi troops trained and equipped by the UK backed Bahrain's security forces. And since then, Britain has given Bahrain £6.5 million worth of technical assistance. Pressure is growing on Westminster to end the collusion. But Downing Street's damning record proves strategic interests trump human rights concerns every time. Bianca Rahimi, London.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Richard Sudan, we have some disturbing developments on the George Floyd case. But before that, we kick things off a little bit closer to home and more bad news for the Windrush victims.
Yes, now we've learned about another dimension to it, and we've learned that many of those who emigrated to Britain in the 40s, 50s and 60s as UK citizens worked here in Britain as citizens, paid their taxes as citizens, and now being denied their pension, which is their right as citizens too, back in the Caribbean. Of course, many of those that first came here to help rebuild the country at the invitation and encouragement of the then government, since moved back to the Caribbean after working for decades in the country. And we've now learned that many of them have essentially had their pensions frozen. Now, this is having massive implications because, of course, you know, that generation are an older generation, many of them dependent on their pensions, many of them unable to work because of their age and maybe health conditions, and some are actually being forced to work in the Caribbean to simply make ends meet. And of course, one of the dynamics to this is in the middle of a pandemic, some of our older folk who, you know, may be being forced to work to just pay the essential bills is a pretty serious situation. Now, from what I can see, Amina, the government hasn't really been forthcoming with much of an explanation yet. I dare say they will, but of course, let's remember, you know, they offered an explanation about the wrongful deportations, and yet we learned that some of those deportations or planned deportees were pulled off planes and had perfectly legal grounds to remain in the UK.
All right, hit me up with two of your best choices of the social media reaction, please.
Let's go to Derek Wilkinson, who simply says the sad part of this whole sorry saga is that it would not need much money to fix. We seem to have money as a country for many things, Amina, and there should be some money for this, people are saying. Gracie May tweeted, I'm late to this, but it's no surprise that a Home Secretary currently presiding over a terrible Windrush compensation scheme, ongoing hostile environment in a pandemic, expanding police powers and prison camps for refugees, thinks Black Lives Don't Matter. And just a reminder, Priti Patel in recent days labelled the Black Lives Matter protests as dreadful, and many people are now basically looking at her in her home office regarding this latest dimension with the Windrush scandal, Amina.
Now we go across to Los Angeles, and disturbing, I should say, is the next story you're going to bring me.
To say the least, Amina, I mean, I had to double take when I saw this headline. Los Angeles Police Department officers shared an image of George Floyd with the caption, "You take my breath away," as a Valentine quote-unquote joke. Of course, George Floyd had Derek Chauvin's knee on his neck for a number of minutes, taking his breath away, leading to his death. And it begs the question, what kind of culture, in what sort of conceivable reality could this be viewed as a joke? And it really gets right to the heart of why many people are calling for not just police reform, but for police to be defunded entirely. And I think as we see more and more of these instances, like today, and we saw Officer Clyde Kerr, a black officer, take his life in recent days because he saw the internal racism within the police, it really puts pay to the myth that the problems in the United States police force are simply down to a bunch of bad apples. A lot of people would say the entire basket is rotten, Amina, and a lot of activists really are kind of raising their voices around this issue. And, you know, there is an investigation which has been called into this incident to question why such a disgraceful image could have been shared. But I wonder just how far that investigation is going to go. I wonder if anybody's going to be found culpable and punished accordingly, Amina.
Of course. And then the question would remain, they would only have placed that in that particular forum if they thought it was a relatively safe space. The online feedback on this one, Rich.
There's a firestorm on this one. I mean, Gavin says, seriously, these white supremacist cops need to be vetted. When will black people have their own hate crimes task force? And Cherry Bomb says, have you seen this? A bunch of LAPD cops were passing around a George Floyd themed Valentine's Day card. Says, you take my breath away. These departments simply need to be wiped clean.
All right, we leave it at that. Richard Sedan, thank you. Now we skip across to Catalan because the pro-union Socialist Party have claimed a narrow lead in Catalonia's regional elections in a vote which saw separatist parties massively boost their parliamentary majority. The Socialist Party, led by Salvador Illa, won the most votes to claim a narrow victory but will struggle to form a government with just 33 seats. The other three main pro-separatist parties working together for independence from Madrid oversaw an increase in the number of seats they acquired in the 135-seat regional parliament, taking it to 74. In 2017, they won 70. The election was marred by a record low voter turnout of 53% as fears of the coronavirus persist. The ex-head of the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi, is facing his first week in charge after being sworn in as Italy's prime minister at the presidential palace in Rome. The ceremony came days after Mario Draghi was tasked with putting together a unity government of economic experts and politicians from across the spectrum to guide the pandemic-hit nation towards recovery. Italy was thrown into chaos after party leaders failed to agree on a new coalition following the resignation of Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte last month. Now the UK has reached its ambitious mid-February target of vaccinating 15 million people, putting COVID-19 jabs into the arms of everyone in the country's top four priority groups. But with this successful vaccination gamble come growing calls for the lifting of lockdown restrictions. And as Sai Poreza reports, some politicians claim they know the way back to normal.
This country has achieved an extraordinary feat, administering a total of 15 million jabs into the arms of some of the most vulnerable people in the country.
One of few successes in the UK government's handling of a pandemic that's left the country of about 67 million with a higher death toll and worse economic damage than many others. But with the situation improving, should the government open the country up for business? Members of the Prime Minister's own party are calling on him to commit to a timetable for scrapping the lockdown in the coming months. But the Prime Minister says he will only follow the evidence.
We've got to be very prudent. And what we want to see is progress that is cautious but irreversible.
Infections are falling but remain high. And former Prime Minister Tony Blair thinks the way to stop them soaring when the restrictions are eased is to issue vaccine passports, certificates that prove you have received the jab. The government disagrees.
One, we don't know the impact of the vaccine.
I think it's a step too far to have your movement controlled locally by some kind of passport or a piece of paper. I think that's way too far.
Some people cannot be vaccinated because of health reasons. It's just not safe for them. So to discriminate against those people and say, well, you're just not able to go to a coffee shop, go to a different country, that doesn't seem particularly just and fair.
On Monday, Health Secretary Matt Hancock insisted vaccine passports were not for domestic use.
But there are countries that are actively floating this idea and proposing it. And in that case, it will be important for people from the UK to be able to show whether or not they've been vaccinated in order to travel.
That seemed to resonate well with the people we spoke to.
I think it's a really good idea, you know. I think that so as we can travel is the main thing, really, what I'm sort of interested in. Getting abroad for a bit of sun.
I think it's a good idea. I think if it means we can get back to doing summer holidays and travelling abroad, seeing family abroad, then I don't see why not.
Monday saw the launching of the UK's hotel quarantine regime, a new 10-day isolation for British residents returning from 33 COVID variant hotspots. Critics say the move is too little, too late.
The UK is under an indefinite lockdown at the moment to curb the spread of the virus. Next week, the Prime Minister will unveil his so-called roadmap for the months ahead. But with his track record riddled with failures in handling the pandemic since it began, will Boris Johnson get it right this time? Saeed Pourreza, London.
Good to have you with us, Ahmed Kabbala. Now, we normally don't focus in too much on perhaps the more popular culture here, but I think the thing you're going to introduce for us will give a real perspective as to why we're singling out this particular item for discussion today.
Yes, we are singling out a film called Judas and the Black Messiah. And the reason why we're singling out this film is usually when there's a Hollywood film and it's related to the controversial assassination of anyone, they usually whitewash the role of the US government. However, this film did nothing of the sort. They showed the role of the FBI in setting up Fred Hampton, who was the founder of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party, infiltrating the Black Panther Party with an FBI informant, and essentially setting up his assassination. Now, there were 99 bullets fired by the police into the home in which Fred Hampton was in, along with other members of the Black Panther Party. Only one shot was fired in retaliation, and that was after several of the members had been executed. And there's even eyewitness testimony, and this is also demonstrated in the film, that because Fred Hampton was asleep, they went into his room, they said, "Is he still alive?" They fired two shots to the head, and then an officer said, "He's good and dead now." So it shows the gruesome and callous nature in which the FBI operated to dismantle a liberation group, the Black Panther Party, in the 60s and the 70s. And this is a long history and trajectory of doing similar things in the US. The same tactics were tried against Malcolm X, against Martin Luther King, Nation of Islam, and other organizations. Now, we've got a tweet here from Caitlin Jonestone. She says, "The best part of the Judas and Black Messiah is the bit where the modern mainstream America pretends that at some point between Fred Hampton's assassination and today, the FBI just stopped doing evil things." Now, we've got some articles that show that's not quite the case. So the first article is highlighting that the FBI sent a letter to Martin Luther King's house, a letter that was read by his wife, accompanied with some compromising material regarding Martin Luther King. And the letter essentially was instructing Martin Luther King to kill himself. And then following that, we've got an article from 2017 which says that the FBI regarded a new US terrorist threat, the black identity extremist. Now, this was done at a time when white supremacists were marching through Charleston. And it shows that they've always seen the liberation movements in the United States, whether it's Black Lives Matter, whether it's the Black Panther Party, as somehow being akin to white supremacist groups when they couldn't be further from the truth. I've got a tweet from Joshua. He says, I wonder how all the people who said the Nation of Islam killed Malcolm feel after watching Judas and the Black Messiah. Oh, you think the FBI and CIA only did that to the Panthers? And there's an important point to be made here, Amina, that this hasn't just happened domestically, but this is what the US does abroad. So Mohammed Mossadegh, Patrice Lumumba, Salvador Allende, Thomas Sankara, and the list goes on. And that's why liberation movements, anti-imperialist movements around the world, from Iran to Venezuela to Korea, have all sought to forge links and develop solidarity with black liberation movements in the US, because they know the same tactics that are used against them domestically is a similar tactics used internationally by the CIA.
I had nothing to add. Such was the perfection of that delivery, Ahmed. And you mentioned Venezuela there. I'd like to have you get onto that story briefly, please.
Yes, so we all know that the US is leading the charge when it comes to sanctioning economic blockade on Venezuela. However, there is a damning report, UN report, that urges the UK to unfreeze Venezuelan gold. There's roughly $2 billion worth of gold sitting in the Bank of England, gold that that Venezuela has asked to use to fight COVID-19, which is devastating countries around the world, particularly in Latin America as well as Europe at the moment. And yet the UK has refused to release it. Now, we've got a UN special rapporteur who has said that the damage of sanctions has caused prolonged exposure and unharm to Venezuelans, and has asked not just the UK but European banks and entities that are holding Venezuelan assets to release it, and has even said that the measures, the regime change measures, is actually interfering with international law and the right for sovereign nations to equal to exist in equality. Now, what's interesting about this is we always see the UN is selectively used by different entities, but when the US comes out and condemns the treatment of Julian Assange, condemns sanctions in Venezuela, then the mainstream media completely ignores it. And we've got John McEnvoy, who works for the Canary, who was with me in Venezuela, who says precisely that. He says, in February 2019, the month after Juan Guaido declared himself president, The Guardian published 67 separate pieces about Venezuela, regularly citing the UN. Now that the UN has urged the UK to unfreeze Venezuela's gold so that the country can buy medicine, The Guardian is silent.
Final tweet
by Moore, he says, it seems that Brexit English have referred to an old profession, piracy.
Wow, you can't even make a joke about that one, such is its seriousness. Ahmed Kabbalah, thank you. And thank you guys for staying the course with us. That is all the time we have for this broadcast. Keep safe.
Oh. insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Ya ayyuhan nas duriba mathalun fastami'u lahu.
O people, an example is presented, so listen to it. Indeed, those you invoke besides Allah will never create as much as a fly, even if they gather together for that purpose. And if the fly should steal from them a tiny thing, they could not recover it from him. Weak are the pursuer and pursued.
يَا أَيُّهَا النَّاسُ ضُرِبَ مَثَلٌ فَاسْتَمِعُوا لَهُ.
O people, a parable is struck, so listen to it. إِنَّ الَّذِينَ تَدْعُونَ مِن دُونِ اللَّهِ لَنْ يَخْلُقُوا ذُبَابًا وَلَوْ اجْتَمَعُوا لَهُ.
Verily, those whom you call upon besides Allah can never create even a fly, though they should all gather for it.
وَإِنْ يَسْلُبُهُمُ الذُّبَابُ شَيْئًا لَا يَسْتَنْقِذُوهُ مِنْهُ.
And should the fly snatch away anything from them, they could not take it back from it.
ضعف الطالب والمطلوب.
Feeble are both the seeker and the sought. So the parables of the Holy Quran must be really listened to carefully, and you should take them into your consideration. And I previously mentioned that this parable, which the Holy Quran is talking about in this verse, is one of the most interesting parables of the Holy Quran. In the previous program, we concluded that the person who is helpless when he confronts a single fly, that person is not eligible to be worshipped. And these mushrikeen, or polytheists, have chosen something other than the Almighty Allah to worship. They believed in God, but they worshipped other than him. And another point we talked about in the previous program is that we look at this small creature as something feeble, but yet we should not consider that as the feeble thing, since even this small creature, apparently feeble thing, can snatch away some things from us. Some Islamic narrations indicate that the idolaters of Quraysh used to plaster the idols that they had gathered and arranged around the Kaaba with musk, mixed with saffron and honey, and around them they used to loudly say some words similar to the term labbaik, here I am. And this action indicated their polytheism and idolatry, as well as the distortion of the saying of monotheists. And they used to imagine these worthless and low objects as the partners of the Almighty Allah. But flies came sitting on them, ate the honey, ate the saffron and musk, and moreover, the idolaters had not the power to take them back from the flies. Taking this scenery as an example, the Holy Quran is somehow reiterating the feebleness and inability of the idols and the weakness of the logic of the polytheists, and implies that the idolaters can see carefully how their objects of worship are under the feet of the flies, and they're not able to show the least defense from themselves. So, do they not ask themselves, why shall we worship these such things?
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. The objective of the Arabic word talib, the seeker, where the verse says ضعف الطالب والمطلوب, the talib and matlub, seeker and the sought, the objective of these words is the same thing which was said previously. The former is the worshipper of the idols, and the latter one, matlub, is the idols themselves. Both are weak and incapable of doing anything in defense to themselves. With regard to this verse, some other commentators have also said that probably here the term talib refers to fly and matlub refers to idols, since the flies seek the idols in order to enjoy of the food stuff over them. So, all in all, this holy verse strikes a very important parable, but at first it tells us and it warns us that we shall be prepared for this parable. One of the practical ways in preaching is to attract the people's attentions first, and then we start talking. And this is one way that the Holy Quran is teaching us, although it has had various and more instructional points in it. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be
saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry, in your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge. We are discussing about the qualities of the pious people. One of those qualities is the issue of avoiding gluttony, which we discussed about in the previous sessions. And today, inshallah, we will discuss about certain dimensions that are to do with the physical, the material, the spiritual side effects of this attitude of gluttony. And inshallah, after that, we'll try to discuss about some of the methodologies of controlling gluttony. So basically, in the sessions in the previous sessions, we discussed about the material and the spiritual dimension of a human being, and how if more attention is given to this material dimension, the spiritual dimension gets automatically ignored, and therefore can lead to problems. And we talked about the importance that Islam gives to the whole idea of eating food, and we discussed that eating in Islam, when when we are told to avoid gluttony, it's not regarding, it's not, we should have a balance in it. That doesn't mean that you don't eat food at all. But of course, there has to be some balance. So inshallah, we will start today with some of the physical and the material effects of taking care of the food intake, especially avoiding gluttony.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, one of those benefits that we have is, for of course, which is very common, is the health, the physical health. Of course, this is also, this issue of physical health has been told to us by the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam also. For example, one of the narrations say that the mother of all cures is to eat less. Eating less is the mother of all cures. Of course, if you look at what the scientists and the health experts tell us today, you will notice that this is very clear. The very fact that a lot of food is consumed means that much of that food material is either extra or it is harmful. And reducing that amount will definitely kick in some responses by the body that will keep it healthy. Another narration that we have is, for example, eating less causes a lot of the diseases to go away from the body. And of course, there are several narrations of this type. For example, one of the other narrations says that eating less means that disease becomes less in a person's body. There is also another narration that says that one who eats less, the amount of pain will also become less. And this is actually very clear, especially when you see when as a person grows in age, he should be even more careful about his diet, and especially about not eating too much, because of the fact that as age goes, the body becomes more of a you can say a place where very many different issues are just different material is just stored, because the metabolism becomes weaker, and you will notice that a lot of fat gets stored in the body, and some other chemicals that are harmful for the body also just get stored and are not released, and some are released without control. So all of these problems happen as age grows. So a person should realize that the way to reduce the amount of pain in the body is to control the amount of intake of food that they have. Another narration says that a person who eats less gives more value to his self, and his health will be continuous. So we see there's a very strong relationship here between continuous health and eating less.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, we have also another narration from Imam Ali alayhi salam, where he says that whoever suffices to eating less, his health will become more, and his intellect and his thinking capacity will also, you know, go towards perfection. And this is very clear, you know, especially because when a person eats a lot of food, there are many effects that happen to him, especially just in the onset when a person, for example, finishes eating a lot, when he fills his stomach completely. You will notice that even his breathing will reduce. a person who eats a lot, you know, the stomach is full, so the amount of breathing is less. The lungs do not get full capacity of oxygen. And this has detrimental effects in different ways. So you notice that a person's thinking capacity reduces. And therefore, even when a person eats a lot, the chances of getting angry very quickly, the chances of being able to think clearly reduce. All of these are there physically. So a person should keep all of these in mind also. We have another narration also that is there in Tuhaful Uqul, where Imam Ali alayhi salam says, the health of the body is actually from eating little food and little drink or little water. So eating and drinking, both of them here are stressed. In the previous narrations it was more about eating, now you told about drinking. Of course, all of these, keep in mind that you need to refer to a doctor also. Sometimes you are forced to drink a lot, for example, if you have a certain condition. But generally, reducing the amount of food intake and also the amount of water intake and different drinks is something that is encouraged in Islam. Or for example, in one of the other narrations, he says that the one who suffices, Imam Radha alayhi salam says, someone who suffices eating less, then his body will become healthy and firm and good. So basically we've seen that these are some of the physical effects, and inshallah, let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that by a simple action of just controlling food intake, we can have very healthy bodies and minds. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال هناه هو في الشدائد ممجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's episode, we're discussing The Reagan Show, directed by Pacho Velez and Sierra Pattingill. And joining me in this episode are Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Neil Faulkner, who is a historian, writer, and author, and has a new edition of his book coming out soon, which is called A Radical History of the World. Now, made up entirely of archive news and White House footage, The Reagan Show is a documentary that captures the pageantry, absurdity, and mastery of the made-for-TV politics of Ronald Reagan during his two terms in office as the 40th president of the US. This documentary shows how the former Hollywood actor redefined the look and feel of what it means to be in the highest office in the world, and also his rivalry with former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev during the Cold War era.
Okay, recording.
The Reagan administration will be remembered for excelling in public relations.
I think that he has captured the imagination of the American people because of his ability to communicate.
To be prepared for war,
is one of the most effectual means of preserving the peace.
That's why New Hampshire needs John Sununu. Sununu.
Together, we'll make America great again.
I think appearance is very important, but it's also staging. It's how you stage the message.
Not for me, honey.
It's a game.
That's it.
Super!
Well, if you'll pardon my stealing a film line, the force is with us.
You have stated flatly that you did not trade weapons for hostages.
What began as a strategic opening to Iran deteriorated in its implementation.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Happy New Year. Thank you. God bless you.
Cut.
Take that, Mr. Gorbachev.
So first of all, thanks for coming on. Very much welcome to the show. And I found this documentary to be incredibly an eye-opening insight into the superficial sort of role of the president in the U.S. And also, I suppose this documentary comes at a fitting time as we see many parallels between Trump and Reagan. And Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating sort of behind-the-scenes look. It's got that inbuilt nostalgia factor. I mean, Reagan himself kind of very much based his own persona on this kind of, you know, folksy, you know, bygone era charms, you know, referring back to his Hollywood career before he was a politician. And the film, because it's got that sort of, you know, the videotape and the sort of grainy look and everything, it's almost an inbuilt kind of nostalgia trip for anyone who remembers him from that time. I think as a film, because it sort of sticks so closely to the sort of found footage and you know, commentary from the time, it allows viewers to make parallels. So, you know, in the trailer you see Reagan saying, "Make America great again," which obviously we have more modern connotations to today. But it doesn't give you that sort of perspective of people commenting back from now to then, and sort of maybe shaping a bit more the narrative of how we went from this sort of, you know, maybe more substance-driven thing to a more sort of style and, you know, pageantry and performance thing. So I understand why they've done it, and within the confines of the structure and the style that they use, it works. But there's a wider story that maybe would allow for more kind of, you know, nuance and reflection on how we got to that point.
But perhaps the onus of the documentary and the perspective is on the rest of the audience to figure out what's happening using the archive. You're forced to be guided through it, really, because without
the
narration.
No, for sure. I mean, you know, it's very much, you know, it puts there and it's asking you, so, you know, how does that resonate today? And obviously there's a huge amount. It's like, you know, now it's Reagan on steroids, you know, because it's not just old style Hollywood production, it's social media, which is a whole different world, but reflects, you know, it's gone from that and it's sort of metastasized into something even, you know, even more pernicious perhaps. Mm-hmm. But I still think that there's an element there that what I would love to see, and it's always, you know, you should never review the film that isn't made, but I would love to see him, how he went from actor to politician and used the media and the performance idea of that. It kind of starts, it's already fully formed. And we don't get a lot of analysis of how he became that, you know, ready-made image of a president.
So, Neil, if I could bring you in here, that was a good point that Lee made. How did you find this documentary?
Well, I agree with everything that Lee has just said, and I think for me as a historian, the problem with it is, and as you say, we shouldn't be criticising the documentary that wasn't made, but the reality is that if you focus on the image, and the image was very, very powerful politically, it was very, very effective politically, because that avuncular, friendly, warm, genial, round the log fire, all American kind of image that was being very successfully promoted was a cover for a range of policies which were really quite pernicious. I mean, massive union busting operation going on, a driving down of wages, massive cuts to the poor, huge shifts in terms of tax cuts for the rich. So the poor were being penalized with benefit cuts while the rich were getting richer through the tax cuts. And this massive increase in military spending.
That's a really interesting point, and I want to delve into that issue a bit later on in the show.
What
we were riding to the airport yesterday afternoon, and my mother was talking about in Arkansas that they were trying to pass a law to give 150 or pay people standing in their home instead of going to the old folks' home. I made the comment, I said, I didn't think it should give anything. I thought we should take care of our own, you know. That's my feelings. My little one, I thought, was asleep in the back seat, and he raised up, and he said, Granny, that's why Ronald Reagan's the president. Stop all these giveaway programs.
Tell me, you had the experience, Mr. President, at one time of auditioning for film roles, and then when you ran for governor and president, you were auditioning in front of the public for office. Which is more difficult?
I have to say, this one is. You have to, well, you not only have to get the part, you have to write the script.
And Neil, there's a moment in the documentary also that's quite revealing, and we see the mask slip a bit when we see that Reagan admits that it was actually easier to be an actor than it is to be a president. Mm-hmm. And he also says that he couldn't imagine being a president without being an actor also. What do you think the film implies then about the suitability of his character for president?
Well, I think to a very large extent anyway, the American president is very often a figurehead who's controlled by other forces. I mean, I don't think Reagan was particularly bright. I don't think he was particularly well informed. He's supposed to have had a reputation for being very impatient of detail. I don't think he was a particularly quick thinker and so on. So I think we need to see him as, I mean, in a sense, the documentary is capturing this, isn't it? That he's the front man, he's the image, he's the folksy image, and the real hard policy is being decided by other people. And it was brutal policy, both domestically and in relation to what the US was doing internationally. So, yes, you could say the image is a construct, and he's quite a shallow figure, but hey, does that make any difference to the Reagan project actually being driven through by this administration? Because it was being driven through very effectively.
And Lee, what did you make of how this character, Reagan, was portrayed in this documentary?
Well, I mean, you know, I think with the best will in the world, even the biggest Ronald Reagan fans would not give him much credit as an actor. But he is uniquely suited for this sort of role because, as Neil says, there are he's got the best, you know, when he was a Hollywood actor, he never worked necessarily with the best filmmakers. Mm-hmm. When he's president, he's working with the very best people to stage and produce the theatre that's going on. And he's got that sort of, I mean, you know, I watched this very carefully. I don't think there's a moment where he's not smiling, or at least he's not. He never looks unhappy. Mm-hmm. He's always got that kind of, the lights are on, you know, I'm on stage. You know, and you saw him in the clip before. He ushers people towards the mic. He's so aware of, you know, his role within the production. So he succeeds so much better as a president than he ever did as an actor, and that's fascinating to me because you would think one has a lot bigger stakes and is a lot, you know, you need a much better, you know, person at the job to succeed as president, but actually a sort of very average to mediocre actor can, you know, whether you agree with the policies or not, be a very successful president in terms of putting his message across.
That is really interesting, and we do learn that actually he's been in 53 Hollywood movies or so.
It's a film about Reagan's years in office and looking at those years through the lens of PR, and in particular how he used PR and public relations to fight the Cold War.
There.
By making a film that let you watch Reagan go from his roles in Hollywood eventually to the presidency, you'd sort of see how his work in Hollywood informed his performance as a politician. So I found this archive called the White House Television Archive that was commissioned and overseen by the Reagan administration. 2,000 hours of footage documenting Reagan's time in office. So Reagan was the subject of the archive, but he was also kind of its author. So as I'm making this film, sometimes I like to joke that Reagan's actually, in some ways, deserves a co-director credit.
So Neil, I just wanted to ask you to shed more political context on Reagan during the time. What was the political landscape like and why was he elected?
I think there's a huge shift going on in the 1970s. The 1970s is a period of major crisis inside a lot of Western states where there's a wave of radicalization, of union struggle, advances by social movements and so on. And also internationally, US imperialism was on the back foot. In the 1970s, it suffered a series of very significant setbacks. The defeat in Vietnam, losing ground in Southern Africa, losing ground in Central Asia, losing ground in Central America as well, with the Nicaraguan revolution at the end of the 1970s. And I think Reagan represents